And my head above water is all that I know how to do. But it's kind of beautiful, oh, oh, underneath it all.
You have come up with some real zingers this week. Some real quotables.
Really?
To the point that I have gone out of my way to write them down.
That means so much to me. I didn't know you were actually doing that.
I've been writing them down.
Okay.
You have you said three things this week that cracked me up.
Is this really what you're opening with?
Yes.
Oh my God, I'm so flattered.
Okay, so first we were watching it was like a Christmas episode of something, and they were talking about Elf on the Shelf.
And
you said regarding Elf on the Shelf, it's literally the panopticon. It's state-sanctioned surveillance.
Oh, man. That's you know what? That's a keen, sharp observation I stand behind.
You also said, because obviously we're recording today from our new house, which has stairs. We're new to stairs.
Yeah.
And you said, every time I leave something upstairs, it's a tiny death.
Still true. I guess that was just like today. Yeah.
And the third thing is we were talking about that song, Who Let the Dogs Out, which I think is a charming song just about letting dogs out of the gate.
Right. Or like unleashing, like let everybody go crazy.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah,
totally.
Right, right. And of course there were rumors that it was about like ugly girls at the club, which is just
awful.
So mean. And to which you said, Baja men wouldn't say that. Baja boys would.
Glad that like our collective delirium can result in something that elicits that much joy. Hello to all of you from the pain funnel. To quote my dissertation research. Hello from the House of Fun.
You were gonna say horrors.
Yeah, but I can't, like, in good conscience, I can't say that. We're just so incredibly blessed. That being said, we have to bitch.
Yeah, we have to complain for a little bit.
First of all, we got the second COVID vaccine today.
Yay!
Pfizer.
Yay!
There are not very many shards of my, like, 16-year-old bad attitude trying to be punk rock, but was actually, like, way too privileged to be punk rock self. Like, there aren't very many of those remaining. But one is that, like, I can't, like, cheerfully join in with saying, like, Team Pfizer to anybody. Like, I can't, you know what I mean? Like, I can't do that with, like, a multinational, like, disgusting corporation. I can't do it. They happen to manufacture the vaccine that is currently coursing through my veins and is making me feel real weird. How are you feeling right now?
I'm a little clammy, and I had chills earlier. But I really, compared to some people who've had really bad symptoms, I feel like I'm...
You're coasting.
I was able to get a bunch of work done today, and
we're fortunate. I feel bad complaining about this.
I honestly don't know if I'm just about to get my period, but we like pulled up to get our vaccines, and I started crying just thinking about the collective beauty that is like everybody doing their part.
Yeah, you were like, we're doing this so that we can keep other people safe and like keep old people safe.
It just felt like, and just seeing all of the cars there, I was like, everybody's doing their best.
I think, see, if like the version of emotional that you get before your menstrual cycle is like just this like sensitivity and sweetness, and mine is just like this like murderous rage where I'm like, I hate every fucking Top Chef contestant. We were watching it last night and I was like, her teeth are too small. Who says that? No, but yours is just sweet. Like that song Slipping Through My Fingers came on and you were like, I'm thinking about our daughter one day.
She's already slipping through my fingers. She's already growing up too fast, our daughter. A mess.
And listeners, we are in a new house since we last spoke to you.
This is so exciting. We're homeowners. I know we've been talking about this, but like it really happened.
It actually happened.
Yeah.
And all the things that I thought I was like above, like moving being exhausting and like homeownership being a pain in the ass, like all of those things are happening. But it's really like I've waited too long for this to complain about it.
Right.
It's kind of how I felt about getting a tenure track job, where it's like there are people that I know who, like, you know, academia is hard. It's a hard line of work. You know, there's a lot of pressure and it's, you know, like all of the like attendant concerns about having an academic job. But I just feel so fortunate to be in a position to complain about it that I can't complain about it.
Yeah, I hear you.
You know, and I kind of feel that way about our house. Yeah. Like, do all the lights on one side of the house flicker and we have to replace the electrical panel? Yes.
Does our bed not fit up the stairs when we're sleeping in the living room?
We have to talk about this, right?
Yeah.
We've been actually, like, I sneaky have been trying to conceal it from the world. So we have a special kind of bed that weighs to 35,000 fucking pounds, and it didn't fit up the stairs. And I didn't know that apparently in advance of our move, we were supposed to contact the manufacturer so they could, like, we could pay $100 for the privilege of somebody coming and taking it apart. So, yeah, our bed's in the dining room and has been for a while now.
Yeah, which is fine, except we also don't have blinds or curtains.
Yep, we decided not. We could have done it before closing. We were like, no, no, why? We don't, like, this whole thing could fall through. Yeah, YOLO.
You never know.
Yeah. How bright can the sun really be?
Turns out pretty bright. And I also, I mean, this is like, you know, I injured my back like a week and a half ago.
You've been really, really, like, so, down for the count.
Yeah. So it's been tricky. And, like, we were both kind of in a depressive episode, too. And,
big time.
You know, we talked about that on the last episode of the pod, you know, being in, you know, it's, and I think moving for a lot of bipolar people is probably really triggering.
Like, yeah.
Finding, you know, stability. Mm-hmm. That's what we spend our whole lives trying to, you know, trying to get that, reach that homeostasis.
Yep.
And when you're in flux,
yeah,
fluctuating through, yeah, spaces, it can feel like you're grasping for security that, yep, you don't have.
It's actually triggered, like, some rapid cycling throughout the day for me,
yeah,
like, of little mini depressive episodes, mm-hmm, little mini manic episodes.
Yeah.
And I'm learning, like, it's times like this, though, where I kind of remember, it's like you were saying before when you're like, oh, I have bipolar disorder.
Yeah.
Like, you realized it. It's situations like this that make me realize that.
Yeah.
And also that I have been, like, blessed with so many different acronyms in my life, like, because I'm also ADD and I also have OCD.
Right.
This is the first time in my life, really, that I've done something that I've had this kind of an upheaval in my life without taking any benzodiazepine or, like, anxiety medicine or drinking or smoking cigarettes. So, like, mm-hmm, I feel like I'm kind of, like, taking all of this stuff on without, I was going to say without armor, but, like, without the things I used to treat these feelings with, right?
Your raw dogging life.
Yeah. Yeah. And so it's true. I'm trying to be patient with all the feelings that's kicking up, but yeah, it's, like, really making me realize, like, oh yeah, I have a bunch of, like, you know, I'm not a neurotypical person.
Right, right.
And
all of those coping mechanisms that you had before, you've chosen something better, but,
right,
you're still learning about what that alternative is.
Totally. And, like, no matter how positive the change is, I think, like you said, any kind of instability, I think, really triggers, you know, like, it can trigger the upswings and the downswings,
yeah,
you know?
Yeah, big time.
But that being said,
yeah, today's a great day. We've had a great day today.
We've had a great day. And I feel an incalculable sense of accomplishment. And also, I feel really fortunate. Mm-hmm. And I remember thinking at some point in my life that, especially when, you know, like, I really stared down the reality of my student loans, like, I'm never going to be able to buy a house. Like, I really thought, like, that might not ever happen for me,
yeah,
you know? Or, yeah, like, if it did, it was going to be a really long time in the future.
Right.
And I had type of feelings about that. You know, I felt like I saw, like, everybody that I grew up with, my friends and family and, you know, my older sister and everybody, like, you know, buying not just one house, but they're on, like, you know, house number two, house number three.
Yeah.
And I felt a sense of shame about that. Not that anybody should. But I think there are, like, expectations that we have for, like, these benchmarks that you're,
yeah,
expected to have hit
at a certain age.
Right.
You know?
But I think this has given me, like, not only a sense of pride and accomplishment, but also an appreciation for how fucking hard it is.
Yeah.
And, like, a retroactive kind of sense of, like, you know, wanting to be, like, patient and compassionate to my past self. Like,
right,
buying a house does not make you a worthwhile human being or mean that you are successful. You, mm-hmm, know, it's just, like, something you can do.
Yeah. And it's something that clearly takes, like, time and dedication, and also that, like, the systems that are built for people to buy houses are, like, they're meant to be gatekeeping.
I mean, and now more than ever,
you know.
Yep.
I think it's really I don't know, just like reflecting on a time that I really needed housing, you know, there was no way I was ever going to get that.
Right.
You know,
I mean, thinking about you could tell an analogous story for like just about every other benchmark in American life now, like, you know, going to college or getting a good entry level job, like the barriers for entry for all of these things used to be a lot lower. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm thinking about like, you know, the post-World War II era where like home ownership for white people was like well within the means of like middle class people.
Yeah.
Like there were middle class neighborhoods and houses they could afford. Right. Again, the fact that like there were like gigantic fucking barriers to people of color.
Yeah.
Notwithstanding, but like I'm in a general economic sense, you know?
Right.
But yeah, I think all of those things are so much more difficult now. I feel like that like college costs like $20 back then.
Honestly though.
And it is harder now to get a house than ever to get like approved for a mortgage. And, mm-hmm. and you know, Mary and I experienced that like, you know, like there were lots of false starts between 100%. Us before we got to where we are now.
Yeah. And I had a lot of shame too for my credit score for a long time that like, man, this indicates that I have less value, I'm like morally a bad person.
Right.
And I'm always going to have a bad credit score. And this is like, yeah, it's an indicator of my worth.
Well, I mean, think about what it is. It signals to some lending organization, your credit worthiness and your like the likelihood that you will follow through with your obligations. Yeah. Like it's a reflection of your trustworthiness. It sucks. It's really, really, really shitty.
Yeah. To look at that number and say, people would look at me and look at these numbers and say, I'm not a reliable person.
100%.
And for someone that like deals with so much shame already, it's like really difficult to look at that number and feel like I have anything to live for.
Totally. You know? No, like, it's really sad. Incredible the level of like psychological harm that it can do and has done. But anyway, mm-hmm. Also everything in our new house
beeps
ceaselessly.
Which is like, I think that's like indicates that we have more high tech stuff here.
Let me tell you something. Mm-hmm. You hear it? I don't know if you can hear it. It's a fucking dishwasher. It's like top of the line, like, you know, like brushed German stainless steel dishwasher. But the one that we had at the house that we rented that we just moved out of was a fucking,
it was a workhorse.
It was like a 70s Cadillac, but like, how do I explain it? Or like an old army tank. Mm-hmm. No safety regulations.
It clearly used like 100,000 gallons of water.
It used so much water. It would just like pour all over the kitchen floor sometimes. No beeping though.
No, and never beeping.
I could stick like, you know, 15 or 20 pairs of my shoes in there and it would just keep kicking. You know, not that I've ever done that. You could put a microwave and you could put another dishwasher in that thing. And this one is like, oh, very delicate and very German, please. Oh, no more than 2 forks. Sorry. And then it beeps. What? Why is there a need in the universe for an appliance, especially a dishwasher? Like when you set the dishwasher cycle, I don't think it's like an emergency for you to know when the cycle's over. But this one, it will immediately begin this shrill, incessant beeping until you stop it when the cycle's over.
And it goes for like every 10 minutes.
And how do we know this? Huh? It's because we're sleeping in the dining room.
Yep. Yep. Yep.
Folks, I don't know what episode number this is. We're
69.
Yeah, baby.
No, I don't actually know.
Let's get into our lies.
Yes.
You go first.
Okay. We have some new Patreon supporters. Welcome, everybody.
Welcome, welcome.
And I hope you like getting lied about.
We hope these lies are to your satisfaction.
And this is for Sarah G, and Sarah G just graduated. So congratulations.
Ooh, congratulations on Sarah G for graduate.
This is a gift from her partner.
Her Patreon membership?
Yeah.
That's the sweetest thing I've ever heard.
So, you know, folks, it's just real sweet.
Folks.
Sarah G invented a ceiling fan that launches compliments at you very quickly.
Pew, pew, pew.
You're beautiful. I like better.
Were you lying on the couch, like staring in the ceiling? Like,
it was last night when I couldn't sleep. The dishwasher was beeping.
Okay, I really like that. Okay. Rebecca B. invented a scented pillow. Rebecca B. is new too, yeah?
Oh, yeah.
Welcome, Rebecca B. Well, you invented a scented pillow. Did you know that? You can adjust the sleepy time scents.
Ooh.
Lavender, a dewy garden, ooh, an old library,
oh,
maybe.
Wow.
And schedule wake-up scents like bacon cooking.
Oh, wow.
Coffee brewing, etc. And the technology is actually highly toxic, and it's still making its way through safety testing, but stay tuned.
I'm obsessed. Congratulations to Becca K for winning the Sea Shanty lyric writing competition.
Sea Shanties had a moment, like,
yes,
about
yeah.
2 months ago.
Yes.
And that moment felt
a little too big.
A little too big. Taryn H. invented perfect brows.
Oh.
A hat that has two perfect eyebrows hanging from the brim. As long as the person you're talking to doesn't have depth perception, you're going to look amazing.
It's an Instagram filter in a hat. I'm obsessed. What the heck? Tamara Y. survived quicksand yesterday.
What the heck?
The trick is don't panic and calmly take out your anti-gravity machine. Very calmly.
You should always, in your mind, is the anti-gravity machine huge or small?
Very big.
It's big, right?
It's huge.
Do you ever have a Nickelodeon moon boots?
No, I always wanted them. Our, the lady who babysat us sometimes, she had four kids and one of them had moon boots and I think I ruined them.
That's not where I thought that was going. Caitlin M. invented the tripod.
Oh.
An iPod whose only function is to suggest foods, media, and experiences you haven't tried yet.
Oh, I like that.
Dude, do they still make iPods?
Oh.
Doesn't matter.
Do they? I'm very curious.
I don't know. It doesn't.
It is like, it's my, you know how I like like to collect weird things.
Yeah, that, you like to collect like defunct cell phones.
Yes. I like to collect them because I think they're going to be worth lots of money in the future.
I think they will be.
Always thought of that. But it is my dream to get my hands on an OG iPod.
You know what? If moving has taught me anything, it's that there's always a good reason to collect like boxes full of defunct electronics that you can move from one basement to the next.
I'm very, very sorry for my habits.
Unendingly into the night. No, please don't. That was not snarky. Everything you have is, oh, shit, sorry.
Ow!
I slapped her COVID shot spot. I slapped your shot spot.
Shot spot. Crazy shit has been happening to Daniel L.
When you use that word, it really...
Is it triggering?
Well, it's just really kind of stigmatizing
mental illness.
No, go ahead.
Daniel was on his way to California to race in the Piston Cup Championship.
Ooh.
And he actually fell out of the trailer and had to stay the night in a rundown town called Radiator Springs.
Uh-huh.
And you'll never guess what happens next.
Wait, is this Cars? Is this a plot of Cars?
He accidentally...
Sorry, I spit on you.
...damaged the road and he's forced to fix it. And maybe he'll realize there are more important things in life other than sponsorships and fame.
Oh, that's the biggest lie ever told. You're pushing it. Daphna introduced a new character. This is so stupid. Daphna, you deserve so much better than this. Introduced a new character, the Dandy Lion.
Aww.
A foppish, funny, and daintily clad lion who wears a pocket square and top hat and gets into all kind of chicanery and tomfoolery and has a funny Cockney accent.
That's cute.
The Dandy Lion. I'm sure that that's already been done 40,000 times.
I think that's sweet, honey.
But this is an alternate universe.
Melanie R. made an appointment, and turns out her appointment is moving our bed up the stairs.
Oh, shit.
Thank you so much, Melanie.
Melanie, you have no idea how much we appreciate
that. We really, really need that.
I had like a mini meltdown about it the other night. Like, I can't. And I think when you're like, I need an eye mask.
Yeah, we got an eye mask.
Hannah got Mary an ice pack for her sore arm after she got the second vaccine.
Oh, that's so sweet.
Isn't that sweet?
Thank you, Hannah.
Team Pfizer. a just and loving corporation and a just and loving God would not make a product that makes your arm hurt. I'm just saying. All right. Do you have any more?
That's it.
Well,
that's
shit.
The podcast.
Thank you guys so much. Do you want to read our poems first? I'm just kidding. So As always, we had an idea. We were going to talk about burnout and literally burnout on the idea of talking about it.
Yeah, I was like, oh, that sounds awful.
I mean, what do you even say?
You know?
Here, ready? Have you guys ever felt burnout before? Yeah, me too. Here's a story about it. Mary says, yeah, me too. Here's a story about it. The end.
This is what Webster's Dictionary defines.
Yeah, Webster's, according to Webster's Dictionary, burnout is.
This episode is about eating disorders, so obviously we want to give a trigger warning that we're going to be talking about eating disorders.
Yes.
And I want to be really mindful about people's experiences with eating disorders. I don't personally experience, you know, I don't have an eating disorder. I have experienced disordered eating, so I am going to talk about my experience, and but I'm trying to be as mindful as possible to other folks' experiences, and, you know, feel free if it's triggering or if this feels like not the right conversation for you, or if you're currently dealing with an eating disorder and this mm-hmm. doesn't feel like a helpful, you know, discussion. There are some resources. There's the National Eating Disorders .org. ANAD.org and EmilyProgram.com if you're currently dealing with an eating disorder. And there's a hotline as well, which is 800-931-2237 for the hotline. It's serious stuff, you know?
Right.
And I want to really take it seriously. And as I've been preparing for my, my workshop that starts in June, I really want to be mindful of people's experiences with eating disorders because, right. you know, like loving your body and disordered eating are like very much at odds with each other. But so often they come from the same, you know, like people are grappling with disordered eating and also poor self-image, you
right.
know, poor
right.
body image.
Absolutely.
So, you know, I just want to be mindful of those things.
Right. Well, you've had kind of an interesting set of experiences, like underlying all of the tumult in our life over the past few weeks, you know, happy as it has been.
Mm-hmm.
You've also had like a positive experience with a health professional recently.
Yes.
And have discovered new resources that you're like really into. So this
yeah.
is a period of growth for you in terms of your thinking, like as you prepare for your workshop.
Yeah.
I've noticed you like taking on new layers of topics around food and eating and body stuff.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know how much of that you want to share or plan
yeah,
to share.
Yeah, no, I would love to. I think for me, classically, I've always understood eating disorders to be almost intrinsically tied to thinness
yeah.
and thinness as an aspiration. And that if you were striving to eat healthy or clean, then that isn't disordered eating. That's just like trying to do good.
That's you know? What I always thought too.
And orthorexia and atypical anorexia don't look like the stereotypical eating disorders to other people.
And what are those? I've heard of one of them. Orthorexia is because ortho means health, right?
Mm-hmm.
Like that's let me see if I can do this. Orthorexia is the goal is not losing weight, right? It's not necessarily tied to body image.
Exactly.
Instead, it is just restricting yourself based on what you perceive to be healthy eating.
Mm-hmm.
Is that right?
Yeah, it's basically obsessively thinking about eating the same way that, you know, anorexia or any other eating disorder is. So you obsess about it more frequently or obsessing about it at all and thinking about eating is not normal eating.
So kind of fixating on like, is what I'm eating healthy?
Yes, 100%.
So I wonder if that's tied to, because I think all of these, like any kind of compulsive or, you know, I don't know the relationship necessarily between eating disorders and anxiety, but it feels like the type of disorder that is fueled by anxiety.
100%.
And I think fear is at the root of all this, right?
Mm-hmm.
So like if I wonder if the fear with orthorexia is like a fear of aging or death or
yes.
illness or
yeah
right?
Absolutely.
And as with everything, it's like everybody has a desire to you know, I mean, most people under normal circumstances have a desire to live long and avoid death
yes and not die yeah
but it's the obsession, right? It's
yeah.
the fixation.
Yeah.
The not being able to think about other things or where it like interferes with your everyday life.
Exactly. And I think that's the same as we've talked about, like having bipolar disorder. Normal people, you know, go through changes in mood.
Yeah.
But for people with bipolar disorder like us, it's the extreme. You
right.
know? So this is just sort of extreme behavior.
Yeah, it's like, hey, Becky, when you're in a good mood, do you go home and order a treadmill at 3 o'clock in the morning?
Yeah.
I haven't done that. Don't worry. Anyway.
And atypical anorexia is, it's the same, you know, attitudes and behaviors associated with anorexia, but they don't meet the low weight criteria seen in traditional stereotypical anorexia.
Oh, what is that? What do you mean the weight? So wait, in order to be anorexic, you have to be a certain weight?
Yeah, you have to be, I think the BMI is about 17.
Oh, I didn't know that. I thought anorexia just had to do with like eating, like with behavior or thought patterns or eating patterns.
Yeah. So, I mean, it's the same thing, but that's why they would call it atypical. Because it's harder to diagnose if someone's not, you know, scary underweight.
Got it. Okay, I'm sorry. I misunderstood. Okay.
And for people with that are, you know, that are larger or have, you know, a higher BMI and, you know, starve themselves and lose weight, they're rewarded.
Even though we know now that BMI is Looney Tunes.
Yeah.
Right?
That's ludicrous just, and not.
Not.
Yeah. Right.
It's like Schrute Bucks.
100%. I think what's so also damaging and counterintuitive to so much of this is that if you are over the BMI of 17, you won't be accepted into most eating disorder clinics.
Right. Can I sideline us a little bit?
Please.
So when you're talking about orthorexia, I wonder if orthorexia has to be you eat like an obsession with what most people consider to be healthy or something mm-hmm. like this. Here's the reason I'm asking. Mm-hmm. So do you know who Jordan Peterson is? Have you heard of him?
Yeah.
So for people who haven't heard of him, he's like a hugely popular, mostly with people sort of like on the political, like center to center right, like mostly with men. I'd say probably like 80% of his audience is young men. He's written a couple of really, you know, of books that have sold really well, like self-help style books called 12 Rules for Life. And I don't know what the second one is. Anyway, he's a psychology professor in Canada. So his daughter's name is Michaela Peterson, mm-hmm. and she is colossally popular, has a really popular podcast, has like, you know, hundreds of thousands of followers on social media. She's developed sort of a platform of her own. Mm. And she has really famously advocated for the carnivore diet, which she is on and has convinced her whole family to be on.
Mm-hmm.
And my understanding of it is that it is actually like only eating meat.
Yeah, wow.
Or like really primarily eating meat. Like she doesn't even season it with anything.
Wow.
And a lot of people who point to the fact that like sometimes Jordan Peterson doesn't look like he's in amazing health
mm-hmm.
will point to this. But anyway, there's a sort of like cultish attitude toward this diet where it's like, oh, I started eating only meat and I feel absolutely amazing and mm-hmm. I'm going to do this forever. And like, I've heard Michaela Peterson say like she would not eat a vegetable. She talked on this.
Wow.
Jordan Peterson was on Joe Rogan's podcast and said that he had like a glass of apple cider and that it threw him into being ill for like months.
Whoa.
And I was thinking about this and I was like, every time I hear anything about this, because you know that I like to know what's going on in the media world that's not necessarily my bubble. I'm just really fascinated by it because these people are like titans in some people's lives.
Right.
You know? These are like hugely popular people, audiences of millions. And every time I hear anything about it, I'm like, this feels, there's no way that's healthy.
Right.
There's no way that's good for you. There's just no way. And yet they speak about it in such an evangelical way.
Right.
And it sounds so convincing.
Right.
And it's like, oh, no, the medical establishment is wrong. Everything mm-hmm. they told you is wrong. And your body has evolved to eat such and such way. And then I think about growing up, my mom being vegan and vegetarian and telling me, you know, your teeth and your digestive system are not evolved to eat meat. It's not natural. It's not natural for people to eat that mm-hmm. way. And I feel like I'm like, what two totally different ways of looking at like human physiology and about food. And I found myself thinking today in preparation for talking about this topic, does that meet the criteria of disordered eating?
Diets are disordered eating.
All of them.
All of diets. In my opinion, obviously, right. I'm not a professional. I'm not a medical professional. I don't have a license. I didn't go to school. I kind of want to go to school after this. You know, like I, from all of the dietitians that I follow, from all of the research that I've done, anytime you are that consumed with what you're eating is like and how much space and time food takes up in a negative way about in your life, that's disordered eating.
Wow.
You have a poor relationship to food.
So in that case, thinking about it, I'm like, holy shit. Yeah. Cause I listened to an episode of Michaela Peterson's podcast where she was talking to some hack and, you know, who was like moonlighting as a nutritionist, you mm-hmm. know? And she was like, yeah, sometimes I just like the craving that I'll get for something other than meat is just like so strong. Like I'll want something other than meat, but I'll just like eat another steak, you know?
Oh,
and even the like the palette of the food is just all this like monochromatic. It's just like brown, 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 brown steak, oh, brown, man. Brown.
I wonder how their bowel movements are. I worry for them.
And I think about that and I'm like, well, it's really none of my business. Like if they feel good, but then of course they have like massive audiences,
mm-hmm.
like a huge amount of just unbelievable right. amounts of influence.
Right.
And especially because like they come from like this world of self-help, you know, right. and fix your life and better right. yourself and all this. So it's an interesting glimpse into like, I think we often think about disordered eating as belonging to like, I always think about like Girl Interrupted with like the yeah. hiding the chicken under the bed. Like
100%.
Or like that's a rich white girl problem.
Right. Right.
You know, like that's yeah. something that affects like really privileged people.
Right.
I remember hearing some comedian be like, there's nobody who's anorexic in, you know, like sub-Saharan Africa. Like, you know, I always hear things like this. I feel like I don't understand. I feel like it's a landscape I don't know much about. But then when I start to pay attention to it.
Right.
It's like when you get a car and all of a sudden you start seeing that car, that yeah. same car everywhere. I feel like I've learned so much about it, even just thinking about it over the past few days.
Right. Same. And a lot of this was brought on by a podcast I started listening to by Christy Harrison called Food Psych. And she has just every episode, just like great guests and obviously, she's, you know, very skilled and talented and smart and has all the degrees and license. So I feel like she's a really trusted source. And obviously, she's a health at every size practitioner and intuitive eating specialist. And the more I've been thinking about it, the more I realize the conversations that you and I have had about food, I think sometimes on this podcast has been about the moralization of food as well. And that there is some demonization of junk food and the way in which my relationship to healthy food or junk food was really informed by, you know, dogmatic mentality of these things are good and these things are bad. And if I do this thing or I eat this thing, then I am inherently bad. And this is shameful.
You think that we have maybe kind of unwittingly sort of perpetuated that on the podcast?
A little bit, I think. And I am through no fault of our own. I mean, this is a conditioning that everybody has.
Sure.
And I think we've tried.
Yeah.
we've tried our best, but I don't know that I have. It's like people that are like body positivity is great for those people, but it's not really, you know, for me.
It's not intended for me.
Yeah. And right. I think that I have felt that way of like, oh, you know, I understand. I get the concept. Yeah. That all food is bad, but come on. Some food is like not good for you.
Yeah.
You know,
I've heard it's yeah. In some people it's kind of implied like, yeah, Yeah, body positivity is good for other people, but like there's something wrong with me.
Yeah, 100%.
Other people can feel good about themselves, but right. yeah, also like, yeah, sure, all foods are good, but really, no.
Right.
Right.
And I do think the more I've been reflecting and listening and reading, sure, like some foods have less nourishing properties than others. Like if you eat cake for every meal, you will probably get a sugar headache and have uncomfortable bowel movements and maybe feel sluggish. So but what intuitive eating says is if your body is giving you those cues that this is like maybe too much cake, then you should listen, you right. know? But like but intuitive eating also says eat the cake if you want the cake, because the issue is like constant restriction and telling yourself that these things are, I'm not allowed to have these. So that cycle of, especially for overeaters, is like binging and then feeling bad about yourself and feeling like you're a failure. And it just becomes cyclical. And I think I don't know if anybody else has experienced this, when you pivot too quickly from diet culture into intuitive eating, and you think, well, surely if I practice intuitive eating, I'm going to lose weight because I'm not actually at the right weight for my body.
Right.
So I stopped counting calories, but I still believe that there were foods that were not as good for me.
Right.
And so sure. I was still in some way policing my intake
or restricting yourself.
Yeah,
right.
Yeah.
I thought it was because you had just like, you were above it. Like you had shut off the part of your brain that even wanted that. That was the impression I got.
And for the most part, it's true. Like I don't feel like I have cravings for like some certain foods.
I haven't noticed you like saying no to cravings. I just kind of figured that you didn't even have cravings for unhealthy stuff because you knew it was bad for you. That's kind of how I saw your behavior.
I guess that's kind of how I felt about it too, where I was just like, oh, I felt like I conquered it. Like I conquered processed sugar and now I am so above it all. And I just, you know, and everybody I talked to, I was like, just use honey for everything. And that's going to change, you know, I was like constantly giving tips out and not realizing that everybody's sort of on their own journey with eating, and that eating is a skill.
It's really like, I mean, I realize maybe this is just the COVID vaccine Pfizer gang, but I just feel like I'm imagining like I have this penchant for any chocolate variation of Pop-Tart. I fucking love them. Always raw.
Yes.
Never cooked. And this is part of my raw food diet. And like if I'm eating a piece of like a s'mores Pop-Tart and I'm like, do you want some? And you're like, no, thank you, honey. I never think it's because you're like, ooh, I'd love to, but I never saw that. I always thought that you were like not judging me, but being like, oh my God, no, don't want a Pop-Tart. That's nasty. Like I thought that like you, not that you had an attitude toward food like that, maybe a little, but mostly just that you were like, that's not good. And I don't want to put it in my body the same way you'd look at a cigarette.
Yeah.
You know?
And for the most part, when like I can, do you remember when we got two kinds of cinnamon rolls? We got the Annie's cinnamon rolls and then we got the Pillsbury cinnamon rolls.
Yes.
And we cooked them sort of side by side. And we each tried each other's cinnamon rolls.
That was jarring.
And I was like, it's not that I'm restricting myself from this, like the really fun Cinnabon cinnamon roll. It's that I actually really prefer these organic ones.
Right.
Like, I just like the way they taste. And so for the Pop-Tarts, you know what it is it's like, it's not about like not wanting, I just don't want it because I don't like the way the sugar ends up feeling in my mouth.
Right.
And so I just have that bad association. I'm like, oh, I just don't like the way it feels in my body.
That's what I assume.
But that's
not restriction.
No, though. That's intuitive eating.
Right. So that to me doesn't feel like, so when you said that you were still kind of restricting yourself, where does that come into play in terms of your current?
I think I had a lot of shame and judgment about fast food. And like peanut M&Ms, like M&Ms around the house, or different kinds of candy, because I have always felt that, oh, I just can't control myself, so I just don't buy them. And then I don't have to be subjected to, you know, being forced to be out of control and have my habits be, you know, feel powerless.
Totally.
And today has been such a breakthrough day. Like we got our vaccines and I was like, let's go get fast food. Like, you know, and I thought I just wanted a McFlurry, but I was like, I'm hungry. I haven't eaten food. I'm going to order some food.
And this is like, I thought I just like died and gone to heaven. I was like, oh my God, can we get vaccinated every day?
And I was like, you know what? Food is meant to be pleasurable. Like, it's meant to be fun and taste good and to be a positive experience. And if I have so much shame around fast food to the point where if I'm out or traveling or on tour, sometimes I would just like, I would be like, oh, I'm so hungry. I would love a warm meal, but I just can't do fast food. It's just so bad for you, you know? And, but just, you got it. You have to eat food. And when your body's giving you signals to eat food, you should follow that. And the amount of space that moralizing food or thinking about what's good or bad is taking up real estate in your brain that is like could be used for something else.
Totally.
And, you know, everyone deserves to be free from that.
Right. I think the a lot of what you're describing really reminds me of the way that I feel about alcohol after following Annie Grace's kind of recommendations in This Naked Mind, which is like I drink as much as I want to. It is not off limits or restricted to me.
Right.
And when I entered, you know, a bar with that attitude, nothing was tempting to me.
Right.
Because I was like, oh, that would be like 30 minutes of feeling good. And then like 2 or 3 hours worth of feeling like shit. That's 100%. Just a bad bargain to me.
100%.
And I think that that's like when the Pop-Tarts, that's what you're doing.
Right.
You know, you're like, maybe it'll taste good for a second, but I don't want the nasty feeling of the fake sugar in my mouth, you know?
Totally.
And so that's a different, you know, I think that's one way of looking at it. But then also like, being like, yeah, I'm not going to restrict myself, but being like, yeah, you know what? Fuck it. I'm going to have a glass of champagne tonight. Like, and if that works for someone, because I think a lot of people who follow Annie's guidance do cut back and they end up having a better relationship with alcohol instead of cutting it completely out of their lives. Right. And in any case, I think all of it is just developing a different relationship with it.
100%.
It doesn't have anything to do with like you can or can't do anything. Right. Like, we're all adults who can do what we want to do anyway.
Yeah, those hard and fast rules are not helpful because they're not practical, because they end up interfering with parts of your life. If you stop going to social gatherings because you're scared about what you're going to eat or there's a buffet or something, like, then that's taking up so much real estate in your brain, and you don't need to be that. You shouldn't feel that tortured.
This is a weak analogy, but I was reading about like how to break your paper towel habit, you know, because I grew up in like a very paper towel heavy household, like just that, like there were just like Sam's Club size, huge paper towels everywhere all the time. And I'm conscious of my contribution trash wise, you know, like my footprint in this world, and I don't want to use them as much as I do. And so I was reading about like flour sack towels, you know, and that adjustment is like a surprisingly difficult one, you know, because like just wiping something up with a paper towel and throwing it away is so easy. And with a flour sack cloth, like it kind of stays dirty, and you have to get used to the idea like, that's dirty, but it doesn't need to be washed right now.
Yeah.
It's just an adjustment.
Yeah.
But even like I felt a certain way about it. And then, you know, this article I was reading said like there are still going to be some times when paper towels are your best option.
Right.
I was like, oh, shit. OK.
Yeah.
If that's the case, I can ease myself into that.
Right.
But if I just shame myself into being like, you know, every time you use a paper towel, like that's 5 tears that a polar bear is going to cry as the ice melts under its feet, you know, that would, I think, make me just shut off to it altogether. I'd be like, okay, I'm not even going to try then.
Yeah, 100%. You know? Yeah, because there's built-in shame ready to go.
Right.
Ready to just fire at you when you
fail. Right from the get-go.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. And so as I was reflecting my relationship to, you know, disordered eating and my body, I remembered being 9 and crying about how much bigger than the other kids I was. And it could be my skewed memory, and I don't always trust my memory as a reliable source, but from what I remember, at no point did my parents say your body is totally normal. My parents said, well, you'll get taller, so just don't gain any more weight.
Oh my God.
or you need to stop eating so many sweets or exercise more, or these sort of tips for weight loss rather than encouraging me to accept and love my body the way it was.
Right.
And I don't think it's their fault. I think it's that's the culture. Everybody, that's what everybody believes.
I mean, like you said, it's like the air we breathe.
Yeah. And I think in my early childhood, when I think back to that time, we were extremely poor. We ate Top Ramen like 4 times a week.
Right.
We relied on the food bank for whatever they had. And if I was staying at my dad's, which was, of course, like a very unsafe, abusive place, I didn't always get fed.
Right.
And I remember being 5 and not having eaten all day because my dad was strung out and trying to figure out how to open up a can of Campbell's soup and crying because I was so hungry.
Oh, yeah.
And so I think when you're a child and your brain is sort of wired for deprivation, you're just like, you're just asking for, you know, food hoarding, like all of these like disordered eating to sort of develop as you get older. And when our family reached more financial stability, we had like actual food in the house, like constantly, and like cool food, like soda and chips and like normal, you know, kids
food. Now you're like, speaking my language, baby, kids cuisine.
And my stepmom was like making steak. Like we literally went from like just Top Ramen every night to like fucking
carnivore diet, steak, baby.
Steaks. And
Michaela Peterson would be so proud.
So simultaneously, the desire for the control over my weight and understanding that food restriction was the only acceptable way to move through the world, and having this food paradise, it was like a real torturous, tumultuous like period of high school for me. And where plus it's high school, you know?
So you're like entering this world where you're like, oh my, like you're developing this like consciousness of wanting to restrict yourself. But now all of a sudden the options are all around.
Yes.
You.
So all of a sudden I had access to all this food, but because it was moralized as bad and I was supposed to be restricting my sugar, but here it was and I never had it before. So my food restriction ramped up and my binging and the shame and food hoarding began.
Right.
So that's when I would start to like secretly eat like a bunch of food or like really quickly eat stuff. And there was also some weird stuff with like my little sister's like 11 years old, 11 years younger than me. I don't remember. But if I wanted something sweet, we had to kind of keep it from her.
Wow.
And so I would have to kind of like secretly
Right.
So there's all of this stuff. It's just like landmines everywhere.
Yeah.
And I think when I was reflecting, I was like, oh, eating disorders like 9 times out of 10 are like emerge because of restriction.
Yeah.
You know, because of that desire to control. And I think for a lot of us, especially people who are perfectionists and people pleasers, that concept of restriction feels so effortless.
Right. Yeah.
Like, and moralizing those foods happens so early and it's so in our culture that it's Herculean work to unlearn all of it.
I mean, it's also just feels like lighting the fuse of a time bomb of, you know, undeterminable length. Like at some point you're gonna cave.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't mean even that word cave is bothering me, but like, you know, if you tell yourself, you know how I was talking to you about how like a friend of ours in LA was like, oh, every time there's like bread anywhere in LA, it's always like just to completely untouched because like nobody eats carbs here.
Yeah.
I'm like, those people are just going to one night just order 30 pounds of garlic bread and just eat all of it in one sitting.
Right.
And because I mean, I think about when I would even go like, I try to go like a day without smoking at the height of my addiction. Mm-hmm. You know, I'd be like, I'm going to quit. And then like that night, because I wasn't truly committed to it, I was just bowing to pressure. I would go home and smoke 3 times as many cigarettes as I ever did.
Right.
And be like, fuck it. I'm not even going to try anymore.
Right. Right.
And you're setting yourself up also that feeling when like you decide not to restrict yourself anymore and you like overindulge is a horrible feeling. It's like, you feel simultaneously relieved and like disgusted with yourself.
Yeah.
It's just not a good cycle, you
totally.
Know?
Well, I think people that deal with eating disorders their entire lives, that's something they pride themselves on, is that ability of self-control, that they will never break down and have that food.
Really?
They'll never break down and have that bread.
And maybe they don't, right?
Right. And that is, I don't know what's psychologically worse, you know, but I do know that for it to consume that much space in your head is terrifying. It's awful.
Yeah.
It's constant, and it is, Christy Harrison calls dieting the life thief.
Oh yeah. Oh my God. Yeah. I always think that the phrase that comes to mind for me, like the times in my life that thank God have been kind of limited, where I've been like really obsessing over what I eat.
Mm-hmm.
It's like this just exhausting level of having to be vigilant. It's like when you have a puppy and you have to just like constantly watch it, and it's exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Or like what I hear new parents feel like is like, you can't let it out of your sight for a second. It's just, and it's the same way. This is where I feel like I feel some kinship with it, is because of my obsessive compulsive disorder.
Right.
It's like, I can tell myself all day and all night that it's like not rational and it's not logical, but I'm like, no, that's my way of having control. I have to worry about it.
100%.
It's like what I said before about anxiety, where it's like my anxiety while I was flying was keeping the plane in the air. I'm like, you don't understand.
Yeah.
If I stop worrying, this whole thing's going down. Like I have to worry.
Yeah.
You know, it's not optional.
100%.
And no amount of logic or people telling you that you're beautiful no matter what, or like nothing can talk you out of it. And I think too, like people, I have known people with eating disorders who can speak so beautifully about why everybody's body is beautiful and why, you know, diet culture is bullshit. And but they're like, and they know that. And yet it operates on a different level than that.
Yeah,
right. Like you said, it's like, well, yeah, for other people that's okay. But for me, I'm in it. I'm trapped in it.
Yeah,
you know,
100%. And I think what is so difficult about this is, and why I think more people should look to counseling and more practitioners of health at every size and intuitive eating coaches, that if you're just doing the research and you're just sort of, you know, jumping in on it, it can be, you can create a diet out of it.
Yeah.
It can become your new fixation. It can be, you know, I think in some of the intuitive eating books, they say, you know, eat really slowly.
Right.
And I think they say that because they want you to be sort of present with your food and really enjoy the, you know, the textures and have pleasure out of it. But I remember, I think I jumped into intuitive eating too quickly. This was probably in 2010 is when I started trying intuitive eating, because I was a binger. I would eat so much that I threw up, and I didn't mean to throw up. It was just like, I was just unaware that I was so full. And for me, I saw it as this new way to control as well.
Right.
To be like, oh, this, I'm going to eat this slowly. And now that I'm eating it slowly, I'm going to eat less and I'm going to lose weight.
You
create those sort of pathways because you haven't embodied it yet. You haven't totally gone through the process of what it takes and unlearning those things.
I think about your desire to make people happy. We have the same, like, people pleasing kind of orientation toward the world, that same tendency, like in different ways and in different stages. And I think about it, and I think about the fact that, you know, the host of this podcast that you're talking about and the guest that was on today that we're listening to, like, that so many people that I have known who have been like in recovery from eating disorders are just like incredibly compassionate, open, like really kind people.
Yeah.
You know?
Very sensitive
people who then like make it, like so many people who are in recovery from eating disorders, I feel like gravitate toward wanting to help other people.
Yeah.
And I think that's because those are the same kind of people who are drawn to that kind of behavior. It's like what can I, it's like the poem of yours were like, how, what shape or size would you like me to be? Like, yeah. What can I do to myself to offend you less or like right. to make you happy? It's like a, that same impulse is like, totally. I want to be what you want me to be. And that you're like sensitive to criticism, sensitive to judgment, like that you're, I think that, that those qualities when channeled toward, you know, or, you know, put in service of recovery becomes mm-hmm. like, you just see that it's just like this flower of like empathy, you know,
right.
It's like that same quality that can make you vulnerable to like kind of the anxiety driven behavior also are the same impulses that make, you know, for such like beautiful levels of empathy and kindness, you know,
100%. And I do, I think that there are, oh my God, she wants a llama.
Have I told this story on the podcast before?
I don't think so.
We got this little decorative llama. It's wearing like a, you know, like a cute little poncho. And we got it in Peru. And I showed it to Turnip once and it became like the forbidden toy. Speaking of
restriction.
And she lost her fucking mind.
Yeah.
And I hid it from her at the last house. And unfortunately, she's discovered it today.
Yes.
She knows where it is on the shelf. And I've hidden it, but she knows where it is. And she keeps just, I mean, she's just like screaming for it.
Turnip is the hunger to chocolate cake.
Honestly.
And so I guess we just give her the llama.
Deprivation is creating the problem here. In all seriousness, though. Like, isn't that funny, though, what restriction does to you? Or like that guest on Food Psych was talking about today. Like, if you make something off limits or make it, you know, if you give it this kind of appeal because it's evil or naughty or mm-hmm. indulgent or devilish or whatever, right. then when you see it, it's like your brain lights up like a Christmas tree.
Totally.
You know, in a way that it's not going to if you look at like coleslaw.
Yeah.
You know?
100%.
And I used to think that that was intrinsic quality of the food. Like a cupcake is like a fucking sugar bomb.
Yeah.
And your brain does react to sugar. Yeah?
Yeah.
I mean, is that because of like an intrinsic quality in the sugar or is that because of the conditioning that we have toward the food?
What do you I think a mix of both for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, there's no doubt that like when you like have a bite of sugar that like this, all of the like wonderful feelings flood in. It's supposed to.
I'm thinking about
the
scene in Arlo.
Yeah. Yeah. Arlo wears ice.
As ice cream parlor. Yeah.
And so I think for sure there's like, you know, sucrose has that, you know, that power to just expand your mind and, you know, make you feel all sorts of good feelings. And I think because the body needs sugar.
Right.
Sometimes the body needs sugar.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It's
right.
not a bad thing to need that. But I think what happens to people is because they're so so accustomed to restricting that it feels like, I don't know when I'm going to be able to allow myself to do this again.
Right, right.
So I have to eat as much of this as I possibly can.
And that's where binging comes from?
Yes, exactly. And I, you know, I was with somebody for many years that I, you know, I now believe, I think, you know, dealt with disordered eating. And I think had a really serious eating disorder. And I, you know, I wasn't allowed to have certain foods in the house, not because she didn't want me to have them, but because she felt like she couldn't trust herself around them.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
I thought it was like out of some kind of concern that like, it, you know, it was going to like have some negative effect just by virtue of it being there. Like it was going to like come in through the pores or something.
Yeah. Well, I mean that too, probably. But I remember her family member owned a cupcake truck and made cupcakes.
And they were an awesome job.
So good. They were so good. And we saw them at a function and she gave us a box of cupcakes. And we were in the car and, you know, my ex said, we have to throw these away. We can't have these at the house. We're going to need to throw these away. And I was like, please, can we save them? They look so good. I really want them. Or could I take a bite out of each of them just to get the, you know, the flavor or something? And
I just felt so sad that I wasn't able to, you know, enjoy it.
Why weren't you allowed to have one?
I don't know.
I just don't see how that, you know, I see the element of wanting to control one's own eating, but I mean, it's neither here nor there, but it's, I think, also, it's insidious. I mean, yeah, it's, if it's a way of like maintaining control, you know?
I think, and it's also possible that my, you know, again, my memory might be skewed and I might have felt like, oh, that means, I might have interpreted that, oh, that means I'm not supposed either, to do right. that.
That might not have been explicit.
Right.
Right.
But to me in that relationship, it was implied.
It was felt yes. that. Right, right.
So I remember she went for a walk and I had hid the cupcakes. I told her I threw them out, but I hid them. And I like power ate like 3 or 4 cupcakes. And it was to the point where I was not, it wasn't enjoyable.
Right.
I was just like shoving them in my mouth because I just had felt deprived for so long of this like really enjoyable food. And I think had I had the experience of here, we have these cupcakes and we can leisurely eat them whenever we want. And if they go bad, they go bad. But, you know, like, let's, you know, let's enjoy this pleasurable food and not think too critically about it because it's just, it's a fucking cupcake.
Right.
You know?
Right.
But what ended up happening is I ate, you know, however many in a row, and then I got the worst headache and I felt awful and I felt really guilty that I was hiding something from her and that I was morally bad. I mean, it then just,
you're
like,
then I imagine you're like, oh shit, she's right.
Yeah, she's right. This is really bad for me.
Right. Yeah.
And I think that that's really where my, you know, my current relationship with food is really like, I've been on this healing path since that relationship of like, oh, I can see someone was having their own experience with food and I don't have to take ownership of that experience.
Right. Totally.
And, but I think it's, I can only imagine for other people who are in relationships with other folks who have eating disorders or experience disordered eating that it can really start to, affect your relationship to food,
right.
Especially if you're in a partnership, you guys are going to be eating the same things.
I think I've talked to you about this before. But I was in a relationship. I don't know if I've even talked about this in the podcast before. Mm-hmm. I was in a relationship with someone who had told me that they were in recovery from an eating disorder, mm-hmm. but not that they currently struggled with it, you know,
mm-hmm.
and found out, you know, like well into the relationship that mm-hmm. this person still struggled with bulimia and had been hiding it from me.
Wow.
And I don't know how to explain the reaction I had was like one of those, like those toys where you pull the wheel and it's like, it plays all these different farm animal noises.
Is that how you felt?
Sad, angry, what? Shocked, huh? Like it was like, yeah. it was so many different things where I was like, my first reaction was like, oh my God, that's so sad.
Yeah.
Like it was just like, that's so lonely and awful and then it was like, how could you have not told me this?
Right.
Do I know you at all?
Right.
And then it was like, well, I remember having this thought of like, because they had they cooked all the time and loved right. cooking. And it was always like pretty heavy, like Southern comfort food kind of stuff.
Yeah.
And I remember at one point during our like, you know, dozens of conversations about it after I sort of discovered what was happening, I was like, I feel like I'm on this journey of like eating unhealthy food all alone. And like you have actually not really been doing this with me because you're bulimic. And like I'm sitting here like, I don't know what I thought. It was like, oh, you're outsmarting the system and I'm getting fat or something.
Right.
Do you know
like
what I
you
mean?
Felt betrayed.
I did. Yeah. But it was specifically like, oh my God, you were going to let me gain weight alone. I remember feeling that way.
Wow.
In a way that doesn't even rhyme with any beliefs I have right now.
Wow.
But it was like the anger brought that out of me.
I could totally see that.
And yeah, I felt so complicated about it. And I mean, I still do. I feel like I got angry when, you know, if only you could just like produce a psychologist, just be there with you at every moment when this happens, like a psychologist genie, you know, but I, if you just like rub a bottle of Prozac and they just come out. But like, I was like, I don't know how to explain the response I had. I was just, but I do know I was completely unequipped to talk to this person about it. I feel like my reaction probably made shit worse. I feel like I had a textbook bad reaction. And I remember trying to talk to my psychologist, and it was somebody who wasn't particularly well-versed in eating disorders. But I remember talking to somebody who was like, you have to know that like the disorder and the person that you love are not... like the disorder is not a mechanism for manipulating you. Like it's not a part of that person in that way.
Yeah.
And I tried to understand it, but it's like somebody even like, you know, I've spent hundreds of hours of my life talking to mental health professionals.
Yeah.
And I had no idea. I still have no idea how to talk to you about it. Put in that same situation with that person, I would have no idea how to handle it elegantly or how to be supportive. Or I remember being like, you just need to promise me you're going to get help. Like, because I can't do this.
Yeah.
But like, I feel fucked up about it. Like, I'm, and I still, isn't it so funny? Even after thinking about this, like as much empathy as I can muster, my first reaction is anger, even looking back on it.
Sure.
So I imagine this a whole other minefield. Like there's a whole other can of worms. Right. If you love somebody who's struggling with an eating disorder.
100%. Well, and I'm sure that there's also from her perspective or anybody that's the person experiencing the eating disorder is like, there's all that shame there anyway of like, I know I'm hiding this from my person. And I'm, this is just another way that I'm fucking up.
Yeah.
Or maybe on the other side, it's like, or I'm doing a really good job of concealing this and I'm winning.
Yep.
I'm like winning my eating disorder.
Yep. I came to sort of realize like, and I think we've all been there with addictive. I even now I'm like, I don't want to use language that's like insensitive. I don't know if you could classify an eating disorder as like addictive behavior, but like.
Sure. Obsessive. Yeah.
You like, I do think there are phases you go through when you're like, I know this is not good for me, but I'm not dealing with it right now.
Right. 100%.
You know what I mean? And yeah. I think I could tell that she was in this place where it's like, this is what I'm doing for right now. Like this is working for me right now. Like I'm not ready to plunge into the depths of, I don't mean to like assume any intention behind what she's going through, but like, I know I've been at that point in my life where I've been like, I know what I'm doing right now is bad for me. Mm-hmm. I'm not ready to face it. I'm not ready to deal with it.
Right.
And it's not hurting anybody else. And that's another thing. Like she wasn't really hurting me.
Right.
You know, but I tried to turn it into like what felt to me in hindsight like concern trolling, where I was like, what if you have like a heart attack and die and I'm the one having to deal with your mess?
Yeah.
You know? It's just as evolved as I thought I was on so many issues, it's I think like you need like you said at the beginning of this episode, it's a big deal. You need to have sensitivity enough to not, you know, make a situation worse.
Right.
To be helpful.
Right. To not take it personally, that it has nothing to do with you and everything to do with their own relationship and upbringing and wiring around food.
I had blocked so much of this out, but I remember saying like, and also I was drinking really heavily. I was just, I mean, I know I've talked about it before. Yeah. I was such a shithead in this relationship. Mm-hmm. This was like me at my absolute worst, but I was like drunk all the time. And I remember we got in an argument and I was like, the thing is like you weigh significantly less than me. So you must think I'm a fat, disgusting monster. Like this kind of stuff where again, it's like, it doesn't have any relationship with anything I think about myself or other people now or then or anything, but there's like just tomes of cultural knowledge that you can draw on when you get scared and when stuff like this is triggering.
100%. Yeah. And I think it also brings up, you know, when we're around people with eating disorders, it brings up our own relationship to food and, oh no, am I doing this really wrong?
It's like a mirror.
Like, is it really bad? Maybe it is bad to eat cake. Maybe I really shouldn't, or maybe I should think more about this. And you know, sometimes the things that dietitians and nutritionists talk about is, you know, the people that know the most about, you know, metabolic processing and caloric, you know, intake and additives are people with eating disorders, not necessarily those professionals.
My ex that I'm talking to you about right now, was studying nutrition and is a registered dietitian now.
Wow. I think you find that in a lot of fields, you know, and especially for therapists and counselors is, you know, people who have had their own trauma and their own relationships to, you know, things that hurt them and want to heal.
Absolutely.
Both themselves and other people.
Yeah. But
sometimes I feel like we go into those things prematurely.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's why for me, like planning this workshop, I really stewed on it. I was like, I want to make sure that I'm not doing harm in the world.
Right.
And that, like, you know, am I at a place where I can confidently give expertise about, you know, body positivity and fat liberation? And, you know, I'm really excited about this work that I've been doing over the last 2 years because I'm like, yeah, I feel like I'm really at this incredible place.
You were planning for it very responsibly. Mm-hmm. You wanted to be like a responsible steward of the material. And that's what I see you as like a curator and a steward of the material.
Right.
You know?
And I think...
And of obviously an advocate from the perspective of your own experience.
Thank you, honey. I really appreciate that. You know, I think that there are some people that believe you can be body positive and also, or like body positive and practice intuitive eating and pursue weight loss at the same time. But, I think that's incredibly dangerous and all in those, you know, those philosophies are at odds with each other.
I'm fiscally body positive, but I'm socially
restrictive.
Fatphobic. Yeah.
And like I think the common belief is like that food isn't about pleasure. It's about regulation and movement and exercise is about punishment, you know? So if we're constantly restricting ourselves on top of feeling shame about how we look because the world is fat phobic and, you know, is really geared and made for one body type and then the other thing that could possibly help us or bring us joy is, you know, exercise and movement, but it's about punishment, then what kind of fucking life is that? That's like constant torture.
You know what I'm realizing? Okay, so if the opposite of disordered eating, if like, you know, ordered eating or healthy eating.
Normalized eating.
Eating, right? If I'm thinking of it that way, and I'm thinking about your average person navigating, you know, like your average urban cityscape. Like, let's say somebody like lives and works downtown in some major metro area. The problem wouldn't be like if they just went through life eating what they wanted to eat when they wanted to eat it. Mm-hmm. You know, what felt good to them, you know, like what got them through the day. You know, I'm thinking about a person on like sort of like an average American salary, that sort of thing. The problem would be what is actually like available to them, not the choices they're making. It's like the average choices available to people.
Right.
And because that's where I keep bumping up against my own cognitive dissonance here is when I'm thinking about something like, I just ordered the new Michael Moss book. He wrote the book, I think it was called like Sugar, Salt, and Fat, which is one of the more transformative books about food I've ever read. Really, really, really shocked me.
Wow.
And anyway, this new book is called Addicted, and it's like about how major food manufacturers have like hijacked all of our brain chemistry. That's the only place I come to at odds is like, what does it mean to eat intuitively in a landscape
that is a capitalistic world?
Right.
Right.
Where most of the options available to you, I mean, just like patently, like the average person walking down the street, the average like convenience store that they walk into, the average option they can afford is not going to be like, you know, something that is like nutrient dense or made with care or even made from like, it's stuff that like human hands have never touched. Mm-hmm. It's like, you know, you can just imagine it like skittering down the line at like a manufacturing facility and putting a puffed up in a bag with air. And like, I love junk food, but if I think about it. It's like, I love it because I have other choices.
Right. 100%.
I love Cheetos because I know that, like, I can come home and have a meal, you know, made with love by you that has, like, all natural ingredients and stuff. I've never just had junk food, you know?
Right.
So that's the only place that where my mind kind of bumps up against this is like, well, what does it mean for someone to eat intuitively in a hellscape?
Right. What you're talking about is just access. It's like, who has access, who has power, who's profiting. And of course, our relationship to, you know, junk food or food that's advertised is going to be fraught, because not only is it moralized that it's like, you know, and even like companies will play into it of like sinfully delicious or
indulgent.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, like it really taps into that guilt mechanism that of course we're going to have really complicated, charged relationships to this food because we don't see ads for sliced apples, you know, like
yeah.
There's no, the big apple isn't like, well, there's regular apple, but like, you know, like big banana,
right,
is not,
right.
Is not.
Ooh, auga.
I just can't say anything.
Like the big raspberry lobby.
Yes, yes, exactly. There, it's not Nabisco, you
right.
know, and there's a reason that these, you know, that these companies are profiting, and it's, I mean, that's capitalism. So I totally agree with you that there's so much more at play. But what happens is we focus on the individual's choices.
Definitely.
And say it is within your willpower and your control to determine your weight and your the way you look,
right,
and what you're consuming,
right. And people who are politically conservative tend a lot more to focus on individuals' behavior.
Correct.
People who are politically liberal tend to critique systems.
Yes.
And to be critical of systems, right?
Mm-hmm.
This seems to be one of those areas where it's like it's an exception. And
right.
Everybody just like thinks that fat people are just making fucking horrible decisions.
100%.
Like, I felt myself doing it. Like, have you ever just like judged the shit out of somebody's shopping cart?
Yeah.
Or I'll be
sure,
like,
yeah.
You know what? My choices suck, but at least they're not that bad.
Yeah.
You know, it's like
sure.
The same impulse is to feel superior and like we're making better choices and
mm-hmm.
like we are, you know, we are more slowly making the inexorable march toward death or whatever, you
yes.
know?
Yes. But I think what they're finding more and more is that people that, especially people with orthorexia that are so fucking zoned into, you know, the minutiae of nutrients, that they end up feeling like, oh, I have this allergy.
Right.
And if I have this allergy, then I'll just cut this out. And then that leads to a different allergy. And then by the time they're, you know, through their fraught relationship with food, they have developed, you know, IBS or aren't able to take
right.
normal poops, and then feel like food is the demon, that food is
sure.
the issue here.
Right.
And there's no, so not only are they, you know, having this really frustrated relationship with eating, but having that frustrated relationship with food and social situations and their life. And what happens is that stress chemical is making things, it's exacerbating everything.
Right, right.
So it's very possible. I totally believe that people have allergies, you know, like
totally.
You can't eat pistachios or you fucking die, you know? So I don't believe that allergies don't exist, but I do believe that allergies are really, really accessible excuse for people with disordered eating.
Yes, definitely.
To say, oh, I'm just allergic to sugar. Or,
right.
You know, I'm just allergic to, you know, gluten, to sort of get away from carbohydrates. And
or that that you can do that.
Yeah.
Like that's what a lot of people can do that.
Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
And that is a sense of, you know, control.
Right.
But for sure, if you like, if you start, like I had a friend that was like, every time I eat milk, I want to like, I want to rip my skin off.
Right.
You know, like that you probably have a allergy to milk.
Right, right. Yeah.
But what I think happens to people is that they just start psychologically making themselves sick,
right?
Because they are so stressed.
Yeah.
And I think that stress does the most damage on the body, not a fucking piece of cake.
Oh, it's a killer. Yeah.
And so that's why when we talk about correlation versus causation, when it comes to quote unquote obesity, the obesity epidemic, it's that, are the symptoms of, you know, diabetes related to weight, or does diabetes come first and weight happens alongside of it?
Right, right.
You know, or like there are just so many unanswered things, and who has access to treat those things?
Right.
Who has the ability to eat more nourishing, healthful foods?
Absolutely.
And then we have the audacity to demonize people for, you know, for their size.
Oh,
I mean, demonize them for their quote unquote lack of control.
Yeah.
Oh, it's just, it's really upsetting and frustrating.
This has been such an illuminating experience for me. I am so glad to have, through you and through what you've been investigating, I'm so grateful to have learned more about this through your process of not only going through your own kind of healing process, but also your preparation for this workshop. Mm. And there are just like all these juicy, tantalizing books all over the place that I'm sure that you're going to have like so many recommendations for people. But like listening to the Food Psych podcast has been really revelatory, even just over the course of an afternoon today.
Yeah, same. Yeah, I've been binging it.
That's not appropriate.
But if you are dealing with disordered eating, or you stuck around and you have an eating disorder and you're listening to this, just know that you deserve to not be consumed about eating constantly. Eating shouldn't be something that you feel anxiety about or the reason you miss out on stuff. And I think it's completely the life thief. And I think you deserve to feel at peace and have a positive relationship with food. And if it's something that is challenging you, you know, I had someone reach out and say, you know, I'm dealing with an eating disorder. Should I take your workshop, or, you know, should I see a counselor? I'm like, absolutely see a counselor.
Definitely.
Absolutely see a therapist, you know.
Your doctor, talk to a therapist, a counselor, a professional. 100%. That should be step one always.
Because to self-diagnose some of this stuff can be really tricky, and it can sometimes put you in a worse spot than you might have been.
Right. It kind of reminds me of that saying, like, if you're a hammer, everything looks like a nail. It's like, if you are not, if you are not getting treatment for something as nuanced and complicated as an eating disorder, then shit can be a minefield that you know, no matter how well intentioned it is, you know? So yeah, I think just 'cause everybody's brain works differently.
100%.
Yeah.
So I'm just sending so much love to y'all. And I just know that, I think there was a statistic, like 75% of women have dealt with disordered eating.
It's got to be higher than that.
It's the majority of the population. Everybody has dealt with disordered eating because our diet culture is so rampant.
I mean, I'm thinking about, you know, when there are cookies out at the department meeting where I work, and I'm talking about people with PhDs in English who are college professors who are like, you know, enlightened, like liberal, you know, like free thinking. They're not exactly known for being like the most vain people in the world. And it's always untouched, you know?
Yeah.
And I always wonder why. Right. I don't think anybody is above disordered eating.
Right.
I think it can affect so many people in so many different ways, and in ways that, like, in my life, I had disordered eating triggered by other life events. Right. And it ended up not being a sustained issue through my life, but other types of anxiety and other, you know, kind of patterns, unhealthy patterns of thoughts are.
And we get treatment for bipolar disorder. Yeah. We get treatment for like the stuff that we experience.
Yep. And cognitive behavioral therapy for obsessive compulsive disorder. And
right.
I saw a video from our favorite Jeffrey Marsh today, mm-hmm. who I just love so much. And they said, you know, you grew up under the influence of a big lie, which is that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
And a lot of their videos will just be like, there's nothing wrong with you.
Yeah.
Like, you're okay. You're good. Nothing's wrong with you.
Yeah.
And, you know, I think that is something that's like so critical to understand with pursuing treatment for any level of mental disorder is like, it's something that you're living with. It's not something that's wrong with you. It's 100%. Not shameful. It's not a defect. It's not, it's not something that you need to go to a repair shop and get buffed out. It's just like, we all need different levels of help at different points in our life. That doesn't, 100%. It does not mean that any of us are deficient or defective, or that there's anything wrong with us any more than you might need to stop and ask for directions. You know, like, that's not a sign that there's something wrong with you. It's a sign that you need help.
That's so true. I think we are, I think women especially are really conditioned to not trust themselves. You don't know what's good for you.
Right.
And we hear that a lot, like as children, of like, you don't know what's best for you. I know what's best for you.
Right.
So you trust authority figures. And those figures are influenced by diet culture and by, you know, the society at large. So, of course, they're going to have their own biases.
Oh, yeah.
And their own, like, issues of trauma.
Yeah.
And so when you are told at a young age that you can't trust your own body's cues and that there is a right way to do something and a wrong way to do something, of course you're going to have a fucked up relationship to it.
100%. I mean, it's a miracle when people don't.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, it's... It's like a game of telephone where it's like a generational game of telephone where it's like you are still hearing the faintest echoes of like your great great grandmother's fucked up relationship with food.
Or with men,
or with relationships
or
anything.
Were you listening when I was on the phone with my grandma and she was talking about Arlo?
No.
I talked to my grandma.
Oh wait, I heard her say something about Birdie. About
I was on the phone with my grandma. And we were talking for Mother's Day and she had just seen Arlo and she was like, she said, oh, well, I just didn't quite recognize you. You know, she is real big, isn't she? And she kind of got bigger throughout the movie. And I was like, that's your weird perception, Grandma. And she said,
Rorschach test.
She said something about like eating too much. And I was like, oh, this is an opportunity. Like, you know, and my grandma, my 90-year-old grandma can still learn things, you know? And I was just like, you know, for me, it was really empowering to play this character and to see that there was not a single fat joke about her.
And
it had nothing
strong.
To do with it. And she was actually strong. And, you know, in the movie, she's actually a vegan grandma. Like, you know, that like fat people can do all sorts of things and do and be, you know, have different kinds of eating habits.
Yeah.
You know, and it was just, she had this moment where she was like, oh, maybe I shouldn't have said that. But it was just like, it cut, like, I saw it. I saw it from going from my grandma, probably from her, from my great grandma, and just hearing, you know, going to Weight Watchers with my mom when I was 13. Like, here it is. And I am so excited that the cycle ends here.
Right.
I'm so excited to be doing this work, to know that our kids, you know, if they end up having a fucked up relationship to food, I'm, you know, like, it will not be because I haven't done the work.
Right.
You know, and I'm going to do everything I possibly can to make sure that they are around really positive role models and really positive normative eating.
Absolutely, yes.
It's exciting. I'm so excited.
It's an opportunity, isn't it?
Yeah.
It's an opportunity to make like a seismic generational shift.
Yes. Yay, I love this episode. Woo! This is like my favorite episode.
I think so too. I also just feel like I'm so much more comfortable right now than I was.
You know what? I think it's our couch.
It's so super comfy.
We got a new couch and it's like,
it's the famous yellow couch.
Yes.
Y'all have heard the saga, right?
Yes.
I'm sure we've talked about it.
Yes.
It's here. I'm sitting on it. It's divine.
I love it. It's a couch for a big bear.
Yeah.
And I love it.
and for a little snake.
Yeah, my babe's a little snake.
All right, it's time for a segment. So I put my feelers out on Patreon. I asked if anybody had a suggestion for their segment of choice, and I did not realize what a runaway favorite, gay or straight, is.
Which is great because it's my personal favorite.
It's actually my personal favorite too. This is fortuitous. Mm-hmm. So, do you want to go first? You want to rapid fire this shit?
Oh my god! Okay, yeah.
Or do you want me to read mine to you?
Okay, I'll read mine first.
Those of you who might be new to the podcast and haven't heard this segment before, you'll catch on. Have faith in yourself.
Ready? Are you ready?
Yes, go.
Tadpoles.
Straight.
Frogs.
Gay.
Toads.
Gay.
Seminary school.
Straight.
Smith College.
Gay.
Mount Holyoke.
Straight. I'm sorry. I said it.
BMX bikes.
Bisexual.
BMI measurements.
Oh, gay. I meant what's fucked up is I meant gay and like the eighth grade boy.
Jesus Christ.
You know, these things run deep.
Sometimes they just slip up.
BMI is straight.
Lucky Charms.
Gay.
Carrot cake.
Straight. Do you agree?
Yeah. Colin Falwell, lead singer of Kings of the Leon.
So straight.
C-SPAN.
Gay. I like C-SPAN.
Being on time and prepared.
Oh, straight.
Going to bed early.
Gay.
Petunias.
Gay.
Yeah.
They're so cute. What a list. That was, okay, the lead singer of Kings of Leon is my... You're my person. Okay, ready?
I love you.
I love you so much. Are you ready for this?
Yes.
Moderna.
Gay.
Pfizer.
Straight.
Helicopters.
Gay.
Asparagus.
Straight.
Monkey bars.
Gay.
That was a really emphatic asparagus is straight.
Yeah, asparagus is straight.
Pillows.
Gay.
Blankets.
Gay.
Puppets.
Straight.
American Girl dolls.
Straight.
Baja men.
Straight.
Baja boys.
Gay.
Flamin' Hot Cheetos.
Gay.
Regular Cheetos.
Straight.
Saturn.
Gay.
Why am I crying? Damn, I should have had my computer on my lap the whole time.
Is it nice and warm?
Yes. Oh my god, this is warming my soul. What are your obsessions?
Well, we've talked about most of them just because I'm over the
moon. We had to front load it.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I'm obsessed with my new doctor.
Yeah, please tell.
My doctor, should I say her name? I don't know. Probably not. I don't know.
Do you like my reaction?
You know, my fear is like someone's just gonna start like request my medical records.
Oh yeah, I mean,
but no, she's fucking amazing, and I've been going to this practice for a couple years now, and I was thinking about leaving because I just haven't had great experiences there. Mm-hmm. My doctor that I was kind of seeing by default anyway, like, left, so I was kind of thrown onto this other doctor's plate, and I was like, ugh, who am I gonna meet next? I don't care.
It didn't seem promising there for a minute.
I've never had a health at every size doctor. I've always been weighed and then told to lose weight at the doctor, regardless for what it is. With what feels like really radical and cool doctors, they're still like, and you know, that BMI is up there, you know,
my
like
God.
You know, things like that. And I started talking to this, my new doctor, and no llama.
I think I have to leave that in.
Yeah.
That
makes
sense. Also, I think she's learned her lesson.
Yeah, she stopped crying.
You're not restricted. Okay.
It's just been really, it was so exciting to talk with her. And, you know, I've had back issues since I was really young.
Yeah.
I just had a really painful lower back that I kind of just like wouldn't let anybody touch, kind of like a wounded dog.
Right.
And with this move, I hurt my back, and it's hurt in a way that I'm not able to bounce back. And usually if I hurt my back, I just sleep on, you know, really, really firm bed.
And yeah, and you wake up and it's fine.
And I'm fine. Right. And that really hasn't been the case. So I think I'm just feeling, I'm like, oh, my body's not regenerating the way it used to. And
this is a lot, like, psychologically, that's a lot.
Yeah.
On top of already, like, a big change. Like, right. You moved out of a house that you lived in for a long time. Yeah. And that was sort of the site of some emotional stuff for you. 100%. And that's a lot of upheaval. Yeah.
And I think, too, I think a lot of people are dealing with, like, you know, how do I feel about gaining weight in quarantine? I think there's a lot of people that have, like, you know, they've been comfortable and they've been absolutely. In their homes and eating, and that's good. It's totally okay to have gained weight.
Right.
And even for, you know, myself, I was feeling fine, and then I gave myself permission to buy new clothes and to sort of even celebrate, like, oh, my body's taking care of itself. And
right, just, right. Like,
this is where I'm at right now, and I couldn't move as much as I wanted to, but, you know, my new goal is to make sure I'm doing, you know, getting my heart rate up once a day and take care of myself that way. And so, of course, when I started talking to her, I had all this, like, you know, fear and baggage of, you know, is this back pain because I'm fatter?
Like, you had some shame, yeah.
You know, and I didn't realize how anxious I felt about it, but, you know, I got to have a really frank conversation with her, and she said, your back issues. So we did a bunch of x-rays, and it turns out I have osteoarthritis in my sacrum. Mm-hmm. And I have some degeneration in my spine, and then I have mild scoliosis in my thoracic spine. So it's just like a party in my back.
You just got a whole, like, a specials menu.
Yeah,
of and, pain.
And I'm gonna be getting an MRI to sort of look at the other stuff involved. I don't know how that all works. But basically she said, your spine is your spine. And I have seen this spine on someone who weighs 100 pounds. It has nothing to do with your weight. And I can't tell, like, I was crying when I was talking to her, 'cause I was like, this is the first time in my life that a doctor hasn't blamed something on my weight.
Yeah. How revelatory. Like, you were, really, you just, powerful. Like, over the moon. I was crying hearing you talk about it. Yeah,
and I was telling her, I was starting to tell her about the workshop and, like, stuff I was excited about. And she's like, I'm so glad you're doing that. That is, you know, someone with your platform to talk about health at every size and intuitive eating. And I was like, okay, great. Like, yeah. I felt like I got this
permission. A stamp of approval.
Yeah.
Right,
and,
right.
And I'm just so, so excited to have found her. It's been really, really
You deserve it. Everybody deserves it. Like, everybody deserves to have a doctor like that who
100%
understands what they need and where they're coming from and what approach is best for them. And,
right.
And I mean, everybody should have that.
100%. And no wonder if, like, fat people don't get, like, the care they deserve is because, like, they're constantly being told to lose weight.
Right. And and doctors won't look past that and look for anything else, like any other explanation. Once again, if you're a hammer and you're a fat phobic hammer, everything looks like a nail, right?
100%. What are you obsessed with, honey?
Oh my God. I am obsessed. I feel like it's even superfluous to say this, but I am obsessed with lawn care. Yeah. I have invested in a lawnmower and a hedge trimmer and a weed eater. And I am just, like, completely obsessed. I bought a power washer. Taking care of our backyard has been such a joy. And yeah, it's just, like, I mean, it sounds so cheesy. The reason I think I'm wary of it is that it feels like patriotism or something lame like that. But, like, the feeling I have, you know what I mean? Where I'm like, take it, like, what is that Rumble Bucket song? That time you called me patriotic.
Yeah.
But, like, when I'm outside, I've just taken a few moments to, like, you know, like, pull off my gardening gloves and just kind of, like, look around and be like, holy shit, we bought a house.
Yeah.
We bought, like, this is our piece of land here, you know? And, you know, so what? We're a couple $100,000 in debt, you know?
So maybe we've opened a few credit cards in the last month.
Sleep when you're dead or whatever. So yeah, that's my first, my first and sure to be an enduring obsession is lawn care.
My second obsession is Top Chef.
Oh yeah. Fuck. We're on that kick right now.
We go through our TV shows and I think we're probably missing a Real Housewives right now. But oh. Like, I can't stop watching Top Chef.
Right. I'm hooked.
Yeah.
And we're on, like, an old season.
This is always what we do. We watch the latest season as it's happening, and then we can't get enough because we have addictive issues.
We can't stop.
Obsessive issues.
That's right.
That, we need to watch another one simultaneously so that we don't feel sad in the interim.
We're watching Top Chef Kentucky right now. A great season. Yeah, great season. Really good season.
Yes.
My second obsession is the baked beans that you made.
Oh my God, that's so sweet.
Mary was watching, it was the cutest thing. She was sewing, sitting in my recliner. That should be another obsession. Put that in brackets for later. And watching Gordon Ramsay, and she's like, I'm going to make you some baked beans for breakfast. I love baked beans. I love, like, an English breakfast with baked beans. And so you made this batch of baked beans, like, with pancetta and that really nice, sweet, balanced vinegar taste. Can you tell we've been watching Top Chef? And just out of this world. Best breakfast. I have been having breakfast that I'm jealous of.
And you've been really into avocado toast for the first time, which is bonkers to
me. I'm only like 1,000 years late.
I'm obsessed with it because I do my, like, I occasionally will have an avocado toast if I'm craving it, but you just been wanting it every morning and I think it's so cute. So, okay. Your breakfasts are just, like, so sweet.
I love, like, them.
It's my favorite thing to make. I love breakfast time.
You are, like, a breakfast queen. Like, and you just love, like,
the love. That's the sweetest thing anyone's ever
said. And I'm not taking it back. What's your next obsession?
My last obsession is Chrissy Harrison's podcast.
It's Food Psych.
Yeah. It is. I mean, it is, like, to me, it's as revelatory as when you found Annie Grace. Oh. Like, I could tell your sort of relationship to what Annie Grace was talking about and, you know, preaching. Like, Chrissy Harrison is, like, changing fucking lives. And her podcast right now, I think, is on hiatus. But if you have not listened to this podcast, she has, like, over 200 episodes. I mean, it is something that
you can really, like, really dive into.
You can really get in and really, like, I mean, I'm just so floored to have discovered it. And I'm just excited because I'm also, like, at the beginning. So there's, like, so much that I get to devour. And, you know, I just also found out about Aubrey Gordon's podcast, Maintenance Phase, which I think I talked about last episode. But there's only, like, 12 episodes.
And so you're just, like, burned through them. Yeah. Hell yeah. That's so exciting. Yeah, I'm so glad. I mean, I've sensed a change and a shift in your kind of, like, aura since discovering it. I don't know if that makes any sense. Probably an aura.
No, it's true. Yeah, my energy.
Something like that.
I feel invigorated.
Yeah, your energy. Thank you. Yeah, invigorated. You seem invigorated.
Yeah, thanks, baby.
My last obsession, this is a weird one. I don't know why this obsession started recently, but I am obsessed, like, can't stop thinking about the erstwhile Capitol Hill Autonomous Zone.
Oh, yes.
Or the Capitol Hill Occupied Protest, I think is what it was called, in Seattle. I'm
calling this late-onset Chaz disorder.
Which is, like, so this was, like, during the, like, protest over George Floyd's death in the summer is, I think, when Chaz kind of found its start, right? And I just, like, every piece of media related to it, I, like, can't stop consuming. And I don't even really know why. Like, it's not really attached to, like, a feeling about it. I can't stop thinking about it.
Wow.
It's just really fascinating to me.
It is, you know, it is a crazy thing that happened. But I remember, like, because it was my city, I remember watching it all unfold being like, I think this is fucking rad. I think, like, I think also, like, the cops were being so incredibly antagonistic. And, like, not that that's, like, a new kind of behavior from cops, like, big shocker that cops are antagonistic to groups of people.
Yep.
But just sort of seeing how it all unfolded. And, we watched the live footage almost every night during that time. And just to see the brutality from the riot police and the SPD, like, it was really difficult to watch just innocent people that were just protesting their absolute right to protest and gather
right
to be to have that stripped away from them and to be like violently like rubber bullets are not a fucking joke. Like it's not, it's
yeah.
not, you know, they cause real, they could kill you.
Oh yeah. No, this was a big deal. Yeah. yeah.
I am just so, and you know, I realized too, I was like, oh, I had a similar obsession where I couldn't stop reading about Occupy Wall Street.
Oh.
So this to me feels like a natural outgrowth of that obsession. 100%. And then do you, you already had your last obsession.
Yeah.
My other, so I've had such a hard time, speaking of OCD and ADD, during this moving process, I've had such a hard time concentrating. And I think all of my, you know, my entire bouquet of mental disorders has been like prickled at the whole moving process. But so I've had a hard time concentrating, but I have started reading this massive, I think this qualifies as a tome, no?
It's huge.
It's about 1,000.
I thought you were reading the library, or not the the dictionary.
The dictionary?
It looks like the dictionary.
Well, it's this book by this guy named Richie Robinson, who is a literature professor at Oxford, and it's just like a humongous book about the, sort of like a cultural history of the Enlightenment, which is period of time that I also studied as far as like the rhetorical output of that period. And I teach about the rhetoric of this period. And I just love, I'm really interested in it and about the relationship between like the American and French revolutions and Enlightenment thought. And, you know, this, the subtitle of this book is The Pursuit of Happiness, because of course that was this, there was this like kind of idea prior to the Enlightenment, you know, when the church was at its most powerful culturally, that life is just this veil of tears standing between you and getting to heaven. And like, when you get to heaven, that's when you can go be in paradise. But until then, you like the idea of like happiness being something that was central to the human experience or something you had like a right to pursue was anathema.
Wow.
That was not
considered that.
Yeah, right.
It's about restriction and chase. Yeah. And,
yep. And suffering and flagellating yourself. And like, you are not owed happiness. What the fuck is wrong with you?
Yeah.
Like, and I think
it's indulgent.
If you think about like, did you ever see that movie, The Witch?
Mm-mm.
It was a horror movie that was set in like, you know, early 1600s New England. And you're like pre-revolutionary America and like even like pre-colonial America almost. And, it's like one of the more, I mean, it's just like this Spartan, depressing, gray, awful life of like suffering. And, you know, like that there was nothing joyful about prayer. There was nothing joyful about being Christian. It was just like the meaning of this life is suffering and you will get your just rewards in heaven. Right.
Right.
And, you know, like blessed are the poor for they shall inherit the earth. Like you will suffer blessed in this life, but you will be rewarded later.
Yeah.
And finally, during the Enlightenment, there were all these thinkers who, you know, they built on a lot of the thought of the Greek, I think, philosopher Epicurus, who was the, you know, wrote about like pleasure. And, and you know, there's this resurgence of interest in his work because he was, you know, he wrote about like indulging in hedonistic pleasures,
right.
that the purpose of life is feeling pleasure.
Bacchanalia.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. And other, and I think that comes from Bacchus, the Roman god of wine,
right.
Bacchanalia.
Yeah.
And, so it was like David Hume and all these other Enlightenment thinkers who were like, you know, to varying degrees, but were like, oh, the point of being alive is what they would refer to as like private happiness. So your own individual happiness. And they would define that differently. Right.
Right.
For some people, happiness would be freedom from fear, freedom from want, freedom from disease, freedom from poverty, you know, the right to pursue things that you want to do, you know, and this is where you can kind of start to hear, right? I mean, this idea of the pursuit of happiness, you can hear that shaped the American, the founder's ideals, right?
Right,
I mean,
right.
Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Right.
And that's an interesting thing to be
that.
There.
Yeah.
It's an almost an odd thing to be there, right?
Truly.
But so that was born of Enlightenment thought, you know, kind of like a revival of Greek, you know, classical thought. So anyway, this is also, I'm on like page 5. So I'm just really enjoying it so far. And I'm really enjoying his writing style. Ask me again in like 400 pages how I feel about it. But I'm just really excited to dive into it as I get more settled. As we get more settled in here.
I'm so excited.
Yeah. I will read my poem first.
Okay, great.
So the poem that I'm reading is called New Year's Eve.
Ooh.
By Tomas Q. Morin.
Mm.
The racial dot map of America says green dots are blacks, blues are whites, orange are Latinos, red are Asians, and brown are Native Americans and everyone else. If this is what passes for hope, then what are the green dots between my tulips and the sea?
Oh.
Maybe somewhere green dots still mean grass.
Oh.
In America, blue dots are an ocean full of fish with no gills.
Mm.
I need to believe I can breathe underwater.
Oh.
When you see your reflection in this map, what story do the dots tell you about freedom and its promises? When I look at Garland, I now see the Transcontinental Railroad and the Middle Passage wrapped around our plastic tree.
Mm.
The year is late. Tonight, the sky will pop with color and gunpowder. Drums pound in the distance. The only color unassigned on the map is white. No people live where the map goes white. White is prairie, forest, whoa, mountain, river, and desert. White is where the coyote growls when we decorate the night sky.
Wow.
White is where the brush waits for a spark to burn it all new.
Wow. Oh my God, I love that.
Isn't that beautiful?
Where did you find that?
It was in the New York Times Magazine, I think 2 Sundays ago.
Oh my God, mm-hmm. I love that.
I just think it's beautiful too. I love it. I think, wow, it's so powerful.
God, yeah, when you really think about when like large maps are sort of, you know, color dotting, you know, groups of people or cities and, you know, what. Oh, I just love that.
Yep, right? You kind of forget about, like, the real, like, the human experiences, yeah, those represent, right?
I have a poem by Blythe Baird that it came up a million times in my searches. Or like when I've just been like looking at spoken word, and I don't know why I avoided it for so long, but anyway, I'm really glad to have, stumbled on it. And her, book is called If My Body Could Speak. And this poem is called When the Fat Girl Gets Skinny. The year of skinny pop and sugar-free jello cups, we guzzled vitamin water and vodka, toasting to high school and survival, complimenting each other's collarbones, trying diets we found on the internet, menthol cigarettes, eating in front of a mirror, donating blood, replacing meals with other practical hobbies like making flower crowns or fainting, wondering why I haven't had my period in months, why breakfast tastes like giving up, or how many more productive ways I could have spent my time today besides Googling the calories and the glue of a U.S. envelope, watching America's Next Top Model like the gospel, hunching naked over a bathroom scale shrine, crying into an empty bowl of Cocoa Puffs.
God.
Because I only feel pretty when I'm hungry.
Mm.
If you are not recovering, you are dying. By the time I was 16, I had already experienced being clinically overweight, underweight, and obese.
Mm.
As a child, fat was the first word people used to describe me, which didn't offend me until I found out it was supposed to.
Mm.
When I lost weight, my dad was so proud he started carrying my before and after photo, oh, in his wallet. So relieved he could stop worrying about me getting diabetes. He saw a program on the news about the epidemic with obesity, says he is just so glad to finally see me taking care of myself. If you develop an eating disorder when you are already thin to begin with, you go to the hospital. If you develop an eating disorder when you are not thin to begin with, you are a success story. So when I evaporated, of course, everyone congratulated me on getting healthy. Girls at school who never spoke to me before stopped me in the hallway to ask how I did it. I say, I'm sick.
Whoa.
They say, no, you're an inspiration.
How could I not fall in love with my illness, with becoming the kind of silhouette people are supposed to fall in love with? Why would I ever want to stop being hungry when anorexia was the most interesting thing about me? So how lucky it is now to be boring. The way not going to the hospital is boring. The way looking at an apple and seeing only an apple, not 60 or half an hour of sit-ups, is boring.
Jesus.
My story may not be as exciting as it used to, but at least there is nothing left to count. The calculator in my head finally stopped. I used to love the feeling of drinking water on an empty stomach, waiting for the coolness to slip all the way down and land in the well. Not obsessed with being empty, but afraid of being full. I used to take pride in being able to feel cold in a warm room. Now, I am proud I have stopped seeking revenge on this body. This was the year of eating when I was hungry without punishing myself. And I know it sounds ridiculous, but that shit is hard. Mm. When I was little, someone asked me what I wanted to be when I grew up. And I said, small.
Ah. Oh. Dude, that's I think, the most powerful poem I think you've read on here.
I'm obsessed with this poem.
That there's that line where she says something about, like, the number of calories and, like, licking an envelope.
Yeah.
It's just, or, like, when she says, like, if you're thin and you develop an eating disorder, everybody wants to help you. But yeah. if you're not,
right.
You're a success story.
Right.
It's like you're not even sick.
100%. And I think a lot of this came up for me, too, when, you know, Tess, like starting to, you know, be open about having an eating disorder.
Yeah.
And the kind of backlash that she has received, I think that any fat person receives when they talk about having an eating disorder, is like people can't conceive of what an eating disorder looks like unless it's something that is, you know, it's something that
you're wasting away.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, and I just think that this poem just encapsulated it so well. And you know, obviously just like so much love to Tess and anybody who's experiencing this and who doesn't feel visible. I think that's what's so difficult about atypical anorexia is that like you don't even feel included in the discourse.
Right.
And you're not even included in those spaces of recovery.
Right. So you're just like,
you're not only are you failing at being a thin person, but you're failing at having an eating disorder.
Jesus Christ.
Do
yeah.
you know?
Yeah.
Like, That's fucked up.
Yeah.
And so I just really feel for anybody that's experiencing that. Again, there is help out there. There is a life outside of counting
mm-hmm.
and obsessive thoughts. And that's you can go visit nationaleatingdisorders.com. ANAD.org, ANAD.org, and EmilyProgram.com. Please check out resources. Google this. You're not alone. There are so many people that have experienced this. And collectively, like we can rely on each other and and hopefully grow and feel better. And it doesn't always have to be like that.
Community love, baby.
Yeah, yeah.
Thank you all so much for joining us.
Thank you guys so much.
And we love you.
Yeah, we love you so much. We'll see you soon.
Be well.
Bye-bye.
Smile at everybody. If they don't smile back, they'll be confused. I didn't even say that very well.
I like that.
Pfizer gang, bang, bang.
No, no, no.